Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk and to this edition of Men's Monday here on Mind Talk. Every Monday, you and I have the opportunity to meet a man who's living his own life, walking in his own path, and having his own experiences, which he agrees to share with us. Today is no different. I am very pleased to welcome back to Mind Talk Bruce A. Jacobs. You may recall that name because Bruce is the author of Race Manners and Race Manners for the 21st Century. Bruce Jacobs, welcome back to Mind Talk.
Thanks, Pamela. It's good to be back.
Now, Bruce, in addition to being a nonfiction author, you are a jazz drummer, a saxophonist, and a poet.
Well, that's technically true. I would put saxophonist in quotes.
Okay.
You know, it's a work in progress, like everything. But I do play drums, and I'm a poet. And as you said, I'm a writer. And working on another book now.
Well, there you go. And you are an African-American man who is a native of Rochester, New York, and you were educated at Harvard. How did that happen? How'd you get from Rochester to Harvard?
How does anything happen, you know? I mean, you know, whatever our plans are, what we end up doing comes from how we actually live. You know, in my case, I, like all of us kids, I have three siblings, three sisters. We came out of a household where we talked a lot, we read a lot, it was really political. My mother especially was involved in the civil rights movement in Rochester. We were the first black family to move onto the street where I grew up on the east side of Rochester. And there's a whole story about that, you know, that we actually could do a whole show about what that was like for people. But the bottom line is that I grew up expecting to be treated as who I am in a world that didn't want to do that. And that led me, among other things, to be very vocal, to write a lot, to think hard about these things. And I ended up at Harvard, where I ran into a whole other level of kind of, wow, like, where am I? Like, how did this happen? Who are these people? Who am I? And I went through that and came out of it with what I moved forward with, which is ultimately just becoming a professional writer. I thought I might be an attorney at the time, but then I found out you have to go to law school. that wasn't going to happen. So,
okay. You were so full of school.
My default position has always been as a writer, but that's really what I do. Most actively in the world, and as a musician, as a professional musician. So, you know, that's kind of the short version. I grew up ice fishing. You know, I'm kind of a cold weather guy. So to me, we're living near Washington and Baltimore, where I live now, is living in the tropics. And people down here laugh at that, and it's funny. I'm what I call a snow snob. You know, it takes about a foot of snow to impress me.
I see.
So you know, like everybody, I'm like a mixed up bunch of different experiences, some of which are in constant flux. And I think we're there as a country. I think as a nation, we're at a point where just as the most personal inner drives that push us can either propel us upward and outward into and toward each other or downward and away from each other. I think we're at that point as a country with rage and with racism. And we can, you know, I know that's one of the things we're going to dive into today, because we really need to. It really has to do with, you know, who are we as what we call ourselves a nation? And what are we going to do with that right now? Because it matters. It's going to define, in large measure, at least the next 20 years of political life in this country, this election.
You know, there have been so many predictions about this election. Before we go to that, though, I noted earlier that you are a poet. And there are many ways that people think about poets. How do you describe or define your poetry?
Well, I think, to me, being a poet, and my poet friends and I talk about this a lot, you know, I think being a poet is being, I'd call it being a soul journalist, like S-O-U-L, journalist. In a sense, what you're basically doing is reporting your soulful experience of, like, being in this world. It's journalism in the sense that you report the facts, right? You tell the truth. But that doesn't mean every story and every poem is literally true. It means the underlying message, the underlying meaning of it, the underlying experience of it is a truth about what it's like to be here. And in that sense, it's like music. It's kind of like word painting sort of using sound and meaning on the page or in the air in the way that a musician uses it. It doesn't so much matter if, you know, you're literally talking about a particular street corner and you get the street names right, as it is that the place that you're talking about in that poem or in that line or in that piece of work is a real place that people can feel and recognize, or that you can put out there as a real place in your experience. So, you know, that's how it works for me, but it's different for everybody, and it shifts, you know? I mean, half of what I write as a poet is in no way what I expected to write, and sometimes it scares the hell out of me, and I don't know what to do with it because it wasn't in the plan. But that's the way it's supposed to be.
Well, there's so much of life that doesn't appear to be in the plan. Share with us one of your poems, if you have one available.
Yeah, I do. This is a poem that's called Cleaning Fish, and it has to do with my father as a figure, a pivotal figure of both rage and love in my life. It's called Cleaning Fish. He liked sex more than what came after. Small brown beings who changed his lover's name to Mom, roughened her doting hands, and robbed him of her gaze. My sister learned to lie sweet nothings. She dodged his anger like a dancer. I was heavy, could not run in water. He convinced me that I didn't like him, that I was a little poacher. He would loom in doorways, catching me always at it again, stealing his space while I hung pinned like guilty meat in his barbed net. So we sought out the gorge. We slid downward through scabbed shale, the boulders harder than our fists, the brown current of the river louder than dinner talk, the surrendered blood and scales wet and thick on our skin, a prehistoric poultice for the fever of our rage. We made the climb back to the car with the fish only when we had to, swinging fresh corpses, smelling of battle, and smiling like two assassins.
That is a very powerful, unexpected. I don't know what word to use other than unexpected. Not that there are poems that are particularly expected, but this one just sort of grabs you and pulls you in, and there's so much power and passion and picture in that poem.
Yeah, well, you know, thanks. I mean, I think that's one of the choices we have, right? I mean, life gives us this power, right? It gives us this elemental stuff we can work with if we choose to. And we can decide, like, what to do with it. I mean, it took me decades, in and out of therapy, to come to terms with, to let myself love my dad the way I always did, to acknowledge how much I loved him, and still do, even though he's dead now. And in doing that, I was able to both ultimately, literally and figuratively, embrace this man who helped bring me into the world as who he is and was, and to understand who he was and what I couldn't expect from him, because I wasn't going to get it from him, and to turn to other men and other people in the world for those things, as a role model and as friends and as people who could lovingly support me and stand next to me. And I think the parallel to what we're talking about here is, I think we're at a point as a family, if you want to call this bunch of people who live in the United States now like a family or a big clan in some way. I wish we were more of that, actually. We're at a point where we can choose, like, what to do with the individual and collective rage that we're carrying about stuff that's gone on this continent since the Pilgrims landed and since the beginning of the conquest of the New World. And I think this election has a lot to do with that. The way that racism and rage, which are sort of two entwined things here, are working together. We have a choice about, and a big chunk of the white electorate has a choice about what it's going to do with that. And we as progressives, people of color and progressives, have a choice about what we're going to do with that. And if we use that choice, I'll put it this way, and then we can get started if you want. The way that I look at this is that racism, to me, and the rage that racism carries, because it's about fear and it's about rage,
yes,
that's really what's about,
mm-hmm,
is one of those things that can make white people's brains fall out of the backs of their heads. Just like my own rage at my dad, right, helped my own brain fall out of the back of my head in terms of what was happening and what was real and what I could do with it. And it kind of tore my own heart out of my chest and robbed me for years of the ability to relate to him and other people the way that I more deeply wanted to. Racism does the same thing to a lot of American white people. And that's what we're seeing now with a candidate like Trump, is the automatic response when somebody who feels scared, right, responds on the elemental level of fight or flight, hostility, conflict, and hatred, instead of digging deeper to take the risk of seeing where that actually came from and what they can do with it that'll be better for them and for other people. That's where we are, I think.
In a 2011 paper, a professor of multicultural education at Westfield State University described a phenomenon that she called white fragility. And she described it as a state in which even a minimum amount of racial stress becomes intolerable, triggering a range of defensive moves. These moves include the outward display of such feelings as anger, fear, guilt, behaviors such as argumentation, silence, and leaving the stress-inducing situation. Would you say that for the persons who identify as white in our society, that they are experiencing what Professor DeAngelo described in 2011 as white fragility?
In a word, I'd say, yeah. I mean, I'm not a white person, so I can't speak with any authority at all whatsoever from that experience. But in general, yeah, I mean, and it depends too, you know, we're people. It depends on the specific person you're talking about in any given case. But in general, yeah, I think she's absolutely right. I mean, if you look at the chunk of the electorate that constitutes the Trump base, the Donald Trump base, these are white Americans who are scared to death. They are fragile to the point of breaking. Because not only are there centuries of denial of what actually has gone on racially in this country that they are part of by default, that they can't and won't let themselves acknowledge. And when you're in a place where you cannot acknowledge to yourself in a conscious way or to others the stuff that elementally the inside of you knows is real, man, you are fragile. I mean, your skin is like glass all the time. And that's where a number of white Americans live today, and it's a terrible place to live. And one of the ways you do that, you deal with that, is by kind of being very, very rigid about the way you approach the world. It's like an alcoholic or any kind of substance abuse addict or anybody who's addicted to anything, really, you know, refusing to acknowledge the rule that this thing has over their desires. And that leads to a rigidity, it leads to a rage, you know, anytime the subject comes up, anything having to do with it that's corrective or that requires them to examine it with any depth is met with rage and with you know, fighting back against that and treating it as if it's an invasion. So that's part of it. And I think the other part of it, for a lot of white Americans, particularly, again, the Trump base, which is essentially working class white Americans who do not have college degrees, primarily male. That's the demographic of the Trump vote.
Which is extraordinary, because in no way can he relate to their experience.
Well, but see, that's the thing. That's right. And I think the real problem here is that on one level, he absolutely has mastered relating to them on the level of rage and on the level of denial and on the level of a kind of vengeful, violent, fighting reactive stance, combative stance. You know, even though he's rich, he's a bully and he's a thug.
Right.
And his attitude, as he has said, at his rallies, is beat the crap out of them. You know, what do they know? They don't know anything. You and I know what's real. You know, we don't have to listen to these people, these brown people. We don't have to let these people with these other religions in because they're terrorists. We don't have to do anything. This is our country. It's not their country. Let's treat it like our country. On that level, he's very, 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 very astutely and strongly relating to a place where they live. And he's doing it consciously. Although there's also a part of him that I think he's just elementally, it's part of his personality. He's a bully. That's what he does. He does what he wants. He pushes people around. And he's emotionally violent. That's his thing.
And the other thing that we know about bullies is that there's some significant self-esteem issues that are not in a healthy place. And
yeah,
so the bullying
right.
is a wonderful mask
yeah.
for that.
If I were his therapist, that's the first place I would go. Okay, what is it that drives you to feel that you're never powerful enough to the point where you have to constantly push other people around and feel as if you're the big guy in charge? Why is that, Mr. Trump? That'd be my first question. And there was an interesting story, actually, in the New York Times, going back maybe within the past month, I think, that really looked at Trump's behavior as a reflection of his personality over time. It really got to this question of what makes a guy act this way? What's the insecurity? Literally, that was the tack they took.
Right.
What's the insecurity that makes a person act like this in public? Well, what we've got to deal with, since we're not his therapists and we can't help him with that, is the impact of his behavior and how other people respond to that behavior. That's something that we can address and that we can deal with, and we have to.
We have to. We have no choice.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Now, you know, there's some evidence that his appeal is starting to unravel.
Yeah.
And I think that might be because after kind of addressing this whole thing, he's a kind of poet, I think. He does this thing, this angry white guy riff, really in a really intuitive, just kind of primal way. He's almost like a musician or a poet to me. I think he's at the point where he just closes his eyes and he does this thing with the audience.
Bruce, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back. Bruce, you were starting to talk about Trump from the perspective almost of his artistry with the people who he has gathered towards him. Say more about what he's doing and how it's working.
Well, I think, and this is one of the things I really respect about the guy. If he weren't about the business of destroying what progressive potential this country has, I would really like him and want to get to know him and hang out with him, because I do think he's got this intuitive gift and a presence that connects with other people. I've heard him speak in other contexts before he started running for president, where he's really, like, brutally honest about himself and his kids and his life, and he made himself vulnerable, and, you know, he just sort of, he says whatever he wants to say. He seems very intuitive in that way, which is part of his appeal, but it also gets him in trouble because, you know, he's saying stuff that after he thinks about it for 7 seconds, he's like, oh, man, that's going to hurt my campaign. I can't say that. Let me lie again and say that I didn't say that. And it drives his researchers and his pollsters and his handlers crazy.
At his best,
what he does, and at his best, I mean, at his most effective, even when that's destructive, at his best, he closes his eyes in front of his audience, and he does this thing. He's like a preacher to the angry white congregation. And he's at the point now where I think it's almost automatic. He's gotten really good at it. And that's really the beginning of what makes a dictator, a fascist authority figure, like, say, Adolf Hitler, work. Fascism is about an audience held in fear and in a sense of perceived weakness, right? They feel impotent. They feel unable to affect or influence the world. They feel beaten up. They feel helpless. They're enraged about it. And here's a strong man who says, hey, all you got to do is, like, trust me. Let go of your idea of, like, you're being in control of how society works. Forget about civil liberties, you know. Like, don't worry about constitutional due process and what the government can do and can't do. Trust me to be the government, and I'll do what you want me to do. I mean, I've actually heard Trump say this at rallies. He literally has said to his audience, for example, he was talking about ISIS, and he said, you know, we got to go in there and we got to beat the crap out of them, and we got to do whatever it takes to get them. And we've got a wimp in office, Obama, who's afraid to do that. And we've got a whole world global order that's afraid to do that. They don't have the guts. They don't have what it takes. I have what it takes. I'm going to go in there and I'm going to wipe up the planet with them. I'm going to, like, blow them off the face of the earth. Now, you don't want to know how I'm going to do that, is what he said. You don't want to know. Don't ask me. You don't need me to tell you. Just let me elect me president and let me go over there and do it. And after it's done, you'll hear about it and you'll be so happy. That's what he said. And the crowd cheered.
So let me ask you this. Here he is saying, put all your brains aside, essentially, and let me think for you and I'll take care of you. And the reality is, black or white, if you do that and if you give this person that authority, what's to keep him from using that same skill on you when he gets mad at you, white person or male person, or, you know what I mean? What's your thought about that? Because it doesn't seem like that piece is being thought about.
That's right. It's not being thought about at all. And that's what I mean when I say that racism, in this case, the rage behind the racism of a big chunk of the American white working class is making their brains fall out of the backs of their heads. That's exactly what I mean. It's like a potion that, like, renders reasoned like unworkable. It's like something that just turns off your ability to think logically and deductively, because you're so possessed. I mean, this is a group of people who are so, and this is, I think, where we get to the meat of it, Pamela, because I think what we as progressives have to understand, Bernie Sanders gets this, and that's one of the reasons why he, if he wins the Democratic primary, will be a better candidate against Trump than Hillary Clinton, at least according to, you know, what research has been done.
Well, he'll certainly be much more different.
Right. And it's because Bernie Sanders, like Donald Trump, understands and has said explicitly that what's underneath this racism is a deep, deep truth that we have to acknowledge. Right? What's driving the rage of these white folks who are for Trump is a deep truth that they understand, which is that they are not in charge of the political system in the United States. They're being screwed. Their careers, their financial lives are in ruin. Their houses aren't worth what they bought them for. Their job prospects are nil. They're at the bottom of the job ladder. Remember, these are people without college degrees, right. Some of them without high school diplomas. Largely males. Everything that makes them feel potent and powerful as a white man in this country has changed or been taken away. They're white, but they're not in charge of the culture anymore. It's an increasingly brown culture, and they can't handle that. They're not able to support their families, and they're supposed to as men, the culture tells them, especially as white men. And they're not able to do that, and they can't handle that. And the reality is that these guys are accurately in touch with how they're being messed over by the power structure. What's been twisted is they're deciding who's responsible for that and who to be mad at about it. And instead of being mad at the small group of white guys, wealthy white guys, who are making the decisions that have turned the American economy against the rest of us, they are channeling that rage with the help of somebody like Donald Trump and the Republican Party's sort of rightward racist positioning over the past decades. They are turning that rage at brown people, at so-called terrorists, at foreigners, at anybody who's not like them, because that's the easier thing to do. But the rage is real. Bernie knows that. These people are not lying when they say that they are suffering, they're in pain, that they're terrified, that they feel impotent and powerless. They're telling the truth. That's real. And what we as progressives have to understand is that they are starting to feel some of the stuff that we have felt and experienced for centuries.
So given that understanding, because there are many people, the people who are for Trump, as we clearly know, are solidly in his camp. He could do pretty much anything, and they're still for him. So the people who are opposed to Trump, who have gotten to this place of sort of referring to them as these dysfunctional, crazy people, that's not going to help them see the broader picture of Trump. So what is it that you would, in fact, what that does is helps them to support Trump even more, I would suggest. So what would you say to those who define themselves as progressives in trying to talk to the folks who support Trump or Cruz or anyone else? Or is there anything to be said? Should we take an entirely, people who see themselves as progressives, should they take an entirely different tact altogether?
Well, I think, you know, everything you've just said is complex. You know, none of it's universal. There are divisions in the Trump camp. There are people leaving the Trump camp who used to be in it. There are women who are starting to desert the Trump camp. He's never been as popular with white women as he is with white men anyway, I think for pretty obvious reasons.
Sure.
And with this latest abortion walk back, where he said these terrible things about punishing women who have had abortions, which offended everybody in doing abortion work, both on the anti-abortion and the pro-choice fronts. And then he had to walk that back. You know, women, a lot of women see through this sort of male bully affect of Trump, and They don't like it. So his, I don't think his support is unwavering or unchanging in any absolute way.
Okay.
I think he's vulnerable too. But having said that, I think a couple of things. Number one, the reason why, as I said, Bernie Sanders is a stronger candidate against Trump than Hillary Clinton is that Bernie has a populist message that's about all of the stuff that the Trump electorate is enraged about, except racism. If you break it down to the issues that Bernie's talking about, it's all the stuff that's driving white American working class people crazy. And what Bernie will do and does, I wish that he could do it better, you know, but he's the only person out there doing it in a visible way. And what we need to do, I think, as progressives, to answer your question, is to say to our brothers and sisters who have been pulled into the tar pit, you know, of being Trump supporters, hey, you know, the rage you feel is real. You know, I know what it's like to be like powerless in an economy that doesn't work for me. You're right. Money rules. This is not really a democracy. We don't have the power to support our families that we should have, the ability to like have affordable health care that we should have. Everything you're mad about is what I'm mad about. We're mad about the same stuff, except you're mad at me instead of being mad at the people who created these problems for all of us. That's what progressives need to be saying to white Trump supporters instead of, you stupid, blind, racist bully. How can you behave this way toward other people? I hate you. I don't want to be anywhere around you. I won't have anything to do with you. You're dumb and ignorant, and you're an embarrassment to America. Now, the emotional response, right, to this dynamic is understandable. People behave like, you know, when you're looking at the beginning of a brown shirt movement of a fascist mindset in the United States, which is a lot of what the Trump stance represents, yeah, it's abhorrent. It's enraging. You know, I'm appalled by it. I'm enraged by it. And, I give myself permission to, like, feel that way, because I do. You're supposed to. But what do we do with that? You know, I think part of what we do with it is put a candidate out there, like Sanders, or in the future another candidate, who can say, you know what, white folks who think this is about us, what really upsets me is that you got it wrong. You're right about everything that's screwing you, except at who's doing it. It's not brown people, and it's not terrorists. It's a certain group of rich people who are controlling the way the American economy and political system works. And I really need you to wake up so that we can, like, tear this stuff down together.
So
that's the way we need to start talking.
In a lot of ways, what I hear you proposing is a very old and actually very basic tenet of the social work profession, which is to start where the client is. And what you're saying is recognize where the Trump supporters and other supporters are. Sort of lean into that, as Dr. Mark Goulston would say, lean into that, acknowledge that, and then move forward.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, it's got to be a reality-based approach. If you deny the reality, which is that you deny the truth of the lived experience of working-class Americans, working-class white Americans, who are suffering, if you deny their suffering and don't acknowledge that that's true, man, you lose from the beginning. Because they are suffering.
Right.
Now, they're not suffering in the ways that we have or to the extent that we have in many realms, but they're suffering. And so I think that one of the places to start, as you said, like to start, is to say, in effect, the way you'd say to a buddy in a bad marriage, hey, man, you're being played. You're being played, okay? Like, so let's talk about that. Let's deal with that. I can't make you do anything, mm-hmm. And if you persist in this, like, stance that you've taken, I'm going to fight you on it. I'm going to fight you, all right? We're going to fight. But I'm going to tell you, to start with, that you're being played. And you need to look around and realize, like, the lie that you're perpetuating. and the harm that it's doing. Because, you know, I'm going to fight to bring all of us around. And I think that's the way we got to do it. Now, you know, our work has progressed. We can't force anybody to do anything.
Right.
And in the end, like I said at the beginning, it's going to be a choice. It's going to be a choice on the part of, say, for example, Trump supporters, whether they are able to hear that and to do that and to start to, like get down to the bedrock of the real stuff that's hurting them, which is the same stuff that's hurting us as progressives and people of color. Some will and some won't. But the point is, in our commitment to driving or changing that elemental stuff, we've got to talk to them in a way that says passionately, right? Passionately, but not judgmentally, mm-hmm. that, okay, this doesn't mean you're stupid. This doesn't mean that you're a bad person, but you are being played in a way that's destroying the country. Stop it. I think that's the way we got to do this. Sanders is the guy who comes closest to that, and that's why if it comes down to Sanders versus Trump, a chunk of the Trump electorate is going to hear Sanders when he says what I just said to you.
And I would suspect the fact that he is male and not female will help them to hear him differently than they might hear a Hillary, for example.
Unfortunately, I think that's true, too.
We're going to take a break in a moment, Bruce, but when we come back, I want to talk to you about the impact of Barack Obama on the fact of a Trump. You know, so many folks have said that with the election of a black president, it was a wonderful thing, but yet there are, you know, there is perhaps some thought that were it not for the fact of a literally African-American president, that a Trump would not have been able to rise to the extent that he has with the reach that he has. So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll pick up right there.
Okay.
Bruce, there was a early morning that you either stayed awake or woke up to an announcement that many people thought would not only never happen in their lifetimes, but never happen ever in America. And that was the announcement that an African-American man was now the president of the United States. As an African-American man yourself, I'd just like you to spend a couple of moments talking about how that realization washed over you in that moment.
It was an amazing day. I mean, you know, for all of us. My girlfriend and I were dancing in the streets, literally, in Baltimore. When they called the election for Obama, crowds of people in the section of Baltimore where we were flooded out into the street, just stopped traffic, stopped everything, and were dancing and screaming and crying and hugging one another. It was one of those moments that symbolized, you know, what this country is capable of. That's wonderful. I mean, I think it's really wonderful with a capital W that happened, that we sort of broke through that symbolic and practical wall.
And then very shortly after that, gun sales exploded, ammunition sales exploded, and there were all kinds of T-shirts and threats and all kinds of madness going on. Again, as an African-American man, what did you do with that?
Well, what I do with that as an African-American man is what I do whenever I see white folks kind of falling victim to that kind of response, right? White folks getting mean and channeling that meanness toward me or people who look like me or people who represent me to them in response to stuff that's making them feel impotent. Which is, you know, I kind of gird myself, I ready myself for whatever might come at me, and I also, you know, I work hard to try to think clearly and not respond to them the way they're responding to me. But then, you know, I also, this is where it comes in handy to be a poet and a musician, right? Because, you know, every bit of the rage and the anger that I feel comes out of me. And I got a good friend. The way he puts it is, man, you cannot walk around in this society carrying heavy metals. You know, whatever comes through you, you know, you got to keep the plumbing running clean, and you got to like let it out in some way. And it's really, really important for us to have like ways to beat it out of us, to scream it out of us, to bellow it out of us, to feel it, and move through it, and let it, like, see it and feel it for what it is. And I think what happened with Barack Obama is that he, because he's a corporate-supported politician by nature, even though he's black, was not able and is not able to change or turn around the forces that are still screwing racist white guys. And so those forces continued to churn. Obama did what he could to try to dig us out of the Great Recession, but the recession itself solidified all of these insecurities and these feelings of powerlessness and rage on the part of a chunk of the less educated male white electorate. And so what happened, which is where we're going here, is that Obama, because he's black, became an even more intolerable symbol for impotent-feeling white people of their own helplessness and lack of power in the culture and in the economy. And so now that folks who had already been convinced that government was a big reason why they were struggling and powerless in the society, now that government was headed by a black guy, they went crazy. because it's like, wow, you've never hated big government as a white person until you've seen big government hated by a black guy. Big government hated by a black guy is like the Antichrist.
Right.
And so, that's why we saw circa, 2010, the rise of the Tea Party. I mean, you know, like far-right and racist populist narratives are not new. I mean, they go all the way back to well, Jesus, you know, they go back actually a couple of centuries.
They go all the way back.
Yeah. Ronald Reagan was like the latest big kind of, I think, sea change in that. He began, Ronald Reagan's presidency in 1980 began the current version of white working class racist reactionary thought, and it's amplified ever since then. We had the Newt Gingrich revolution in the 90s, and then we had the Tea Party, and the Tea Party was part of this ramped up hatred toward government because it was headed by a black guy. You remember when the Tea Party rallies exploded?
Yes.
And among the events at Tea Party rallies were explicitly racist actions and remarks.
Absolutely.
Black participants and spectators were spat upon, were called names. You know, some of the same stuff you see at Trump rallies, and it's the same mentality. And as you're suggesting, this had everything to do with the face of government being a black person via Barack Obama. Obama's very presence has, for white folks who've been taught and trained to interpret powerlessness as the work of brown people, right? To interpret brown people as their tormentors, Barack Obama's presence has intensified their own extremism, to put it simply. You know, and a lot of what Trump is cashing into, as you said, wouldn't be possible at this level if these folks had not had 8 years of Barack Obama to chew on.
You know, I'm wondering something as we're talking. We know about all the myths and the beliefs about black men in particular. They're the ones who are the thieves. They're the ones who are taking everything from you. So the connection for those who connected that way between Barack Obama as a man and as a black man and them feeling a loss, you know, it's a relatively easy path for them to walk. What if it had been Michelle Obama as the president? Do you think the hatred would be as vile as it is? Or do you think that...
Yeah. I'm sorry what you said is so interesting that it just made me want to jump in.
jump away.
I mean, the short answer is I don't know. We don't know. You know. but it's really really interesting to look at it that way, because I think it could have gone any number of ways. I mean, her being a black woman could have brought out even more of the sexist as well as racist resentment toward women who wield power. And as you know, historically, part of this racist narrative in the United States has been a kind of sexual animization of black women as well as of black men.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
True.
Kind of painting us as sexually driven, primal, dangerous beasts for whom whites are trained to carry a kind of submerged desire as well as a kind of displayed revulsion.
Right.
Which is a weird thing in and of itself. I
Indeed.
Mean, to be in that place has got to be terrible. That's really got to suck, to be blunt, to be frank about it. So it's possible that there could be, you know, that kind of response where, you know, oh, geez, not only is a black person, it's a black woman. You know, we're just being like, as men, there's just nothing left for us now. You know, what are we going to do? So there could have been that. or there could have been a blunting of some of the rage, because she's a woman, and, you know, in our culture, you know, women, the culture of womanhood, like, carries a different, it's got a different shape in the culture. It's more relational as it's defined and as it's taught. It's more relational. It's less physically confrontive and aggressive as we're taught, as we're socialized. And by those rules, you know, it would really be interesting to see what the response would be. I would bet that in either case, the trained impotency of a lot of these white male enraged voters, either way, whether through patriarchy or through racism, I think the machinery would have cranked up to respond intuitively to it pretty much the way it has. But I don't know. It's a really interesting thing to think about, as it'll be interesting to see what happens if Hillary Clinton wins the presidency.
Yeah, that will be interesting on a lot of levels. You know, I'm reminded of a comment that Rush Limbaugh made some time back. You'll have to pardon me. When he said that the days of black people not, and he didn't use the word black people, not having any power, those days are over, and they are angry and they want to use their power as a means of retribution. So clearly in that statement, what he's saying is that there's something for which this entire group of people feels the need for retribution. So fascinating, predicting doom at the hands of this African-American president because he's African-American, but also acknowledging that there are things about which to be incredibly angry. It's interesting.
Yeah. I think that's right. I mean, you know, this white fear, this trained, ingrained white fear that that black folks are going to get us, which is based, as you said, on the awareness, the deep awareness that a lot of white Americans have of the fact that black Americans have reasons to hate white people, right? That deep awareness leads to a fear of revenge that I think the white American body politic has been looking back over its shoulder at for centuries now, for centuries. And Barack Obama, when he took office as a black man, as an African American male, like you say, represented a lot of that. It was like, oh my God, all right, he's there. He's in the seat of the greatest power on the globe. Mm-hmm. When in fact, what you're really hiding is your own sense of culpability and impotence about what was done before you were born as a white person. So it's, yeah, I do think Obama was a vehicle and is a vehicle for white people's like inability to deal rationally with how we handle the injustices rendered upon brown people in this country. They're kind of trapped in this place where the only place they can see it going is some sort of violent retribution on the part of black people and brown people. And they're terrified of that, which is why there's a sense of a need for a strong man like Trump.
You know, the other thing that's interesting about this is there was an author, Dr. Melvin Connor, and he came out with a book within the last year in which he talked about the rise of rise to power of women. And appropriately so. And he really talked about the way in which women, and he goes through a long history, are better, if you will, able to manage and to lead. And he had gotten death threats when his book came out. So, you know, when I'm the way that I'm pulling them together is, so we got one guy who's saying that men in terms of being in the power place is, you know, about to be obsolete if we really want to live and survive. And then we got this other group of people being told, you know, these black people are going to come get you. That's a pretty scary place for these folks to be.
Yeah. I mean, it is. That's what you know, racist, you know, racial supremacy and patriarchy, respectively, do, is they trap people in a place where they can't imagine life as livable, right? They can't imagine themselves surviving without having monopoly on power. Where men can't imagine themselves, like, surviving in a marriage or in society without a monopoly on power, right? And where white people can't imagine themselves surviving in a society, in a shared space with people of other races, without having sort of a monopoly on power over the culture and over the economy and the politics. And if you lock yourself in that place, man, it's not going to end well for you. Because this is, you know, this is a brown, an increasingly brown country. It's going to be a majority brown country very soon. And again, elementally, a lot of white people know that. And their sense that there's no dignified, powerful way out of that for themselves, I think is what fuels the desperate rage behind the appeal of a character like Trump. It's like the last gasp of a desperate section of the white electorate that wants to hang on to this idea that they are in charge of the culture, that this is their country, even though they, in fact, took it by force from the people who were here first, and that they want things to go back to the way they thought they were before.
Indeed.
When, in fact, it's never really been that way. It's all a kind of contrived narrative. And it's time to face up to the truth. And that's something, if we're going to survive as a country, that we have to do together, collectively.
And
it's not going to be pretty.
There's another truth, which is that we are pretty much out of time for today. But I know that we will have you back again. And I do thank you very much for your time and your energy today. If you'd very quickly give us your website or blog address.
Yeah, my blog is Alias Bruce, that's AliasBruce, at typepad.com. typepad.com.
Terrific. Bruce A. Jacobs, thank you very much. We will have you back again soon.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Alrighty. And folks, thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk, which is brought to you daily as an educational public service and can be listened to on demand at myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you'd like to be in touch with me, you can certainly get to me through the mindtalk.org website. And folks, remember, if it's unacceptable, that is exactly what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.